From 7CTOs, my name is Etienne De Bruin, and you're listening to the CTO Podcast. Every week, I spend time with fascinating people that enrich the lives of chief technology officers around the world. From perfecting the basics of building technology organizations to inspiring our minds into shaping our future. As always, the CTO Podcast is brought to you by 7CTOs, helping CTOs become world-class leaders. Let's go. On the CTO Podcast today, we have Murad Zarouk. Him and I geek out on being immigrants in the United States. He's Algerian. I'm South African. So if you want to not hear about that, skip 10, 15 minutes. Murad is the CTO of Splash, which is a cutting-edge modern event platform provider. He has been a technology leader for almost 3 decades, delivering solutions in vision-guided robotics, e-commerce, business application platforms, real estate technology, and now event technology. Murad has a PhD in computer science from University of Southern California, lives in Pasadena with his wife and 2 children. And you'll hear us geek out on AI, the impact it has on our developer teams, how we CTO our developers through the AI revolution. And then we go really meta with AIs not needing to use the English language to communicate with each other. So hope you enjoy this. See you on the flip side. I'm so happy to have you, man. We're fellow Africans.
Aren't we?
Do you feel like you're African? You're Moroccan, right? No?
Algerian.
Algerian. Wait, did I just insult you by calling an Algerian a Moroccan?
No, actually, almost the same thing.
Okay.
You being on the southern tip of South Africa, you know, doesn't make me feel less connected with you either.
Interesting. Now, are you, sometimes I talk to people from Egypt and they will not really identify with the African part of, I guess maybe it depends on heritage and all that, but I am always very interested in my northern friends from the northern side of the continent. If you feel like we're all part of the same continent, or if it's very much a Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, European vibe more. I don't know. I've never been there, so I'm really curious.
It depends what you conceive African to be. In my own life experience, being African really meant this huge diversity that is part of everyday life, whether it's historical aspects, language, skin color, things of that sort. And I think that's true everywhere you go in Africa, or most places in Africa. And also the old history, and having been in the United States for 30 years, I can see the difference. I can feel the difference. You can see how young a country this is.
Wow.
Very exciting, you know, in terms of diversity and all of that. But there's some elements missing in terms of the long-standing history and how all that diversity has manifested itself, sometimes in very exciting ways, sometimes in historically not so exciting ways, like everywhere.
Yes. I've also been in the States for almost 30 years. When did you come over?
Late 80s.
Late 80s. Okay, well then, maybe mine is shorter. I came over in 2000. So you're 10 years, 12 years ahead of me. A lot of people will say to me, hey, your accent is still very South African, and I feel really proud about that. Are you actively trying not to sound American?
No. I try to sound as coherent as I can, and I can't help it. I can't help it. I grew up with 2 languages, Arabic and French, so you kind of are not necessarily, I guess, linked to any particular accent in a strong way. It's kind of funny, especially in North Africa, because of all the historical influence of whether it's Roman, Berber, Arabic, French, and the rest of the Mediterranean. So you get this hodgepodge of different ways in which you can experience an accent, depending on which part of the country you go, and even parts of North Africa you go. So to me, when I started learning English in school, it just became yet another tool, another means of communication. Accent, I think accent has evolved over the course of time. I still meet people who tell me, I have no accent. Yet others tell me, oh, you have an accent. Where are you from? And I explained, I'm from North Africa, because only if I say Algeria, many people don't have any clue where that is. And near Morocco. Oh, Morocco, sure. Casablanca. Oh, yeah, I know where that is.
Yeah, I the closest I got to North Africa was Gibraltar. So I was looking over the ocean for my Moroccan friends. Algeria is next to Morocco, am I right? I'm going to be so that's embarrassed right. Right now. Okay, good.
Yeah, that's right, to the east of Morocco.
You know, as a South African who has experienced success in the tech scene in the States, I feel very connected to South Africa in terms of how I can help, and maybe I feel like I'm constantly being prepared for giving back, and somehow I have this image in my head that the time will come where I can really sort of start making an impact and give back to my country. Do you feel the same way about Algeria?
Interesting that you say that. I do. As a matter of fact, I even had an experience just late last year where there was an initiative sponsored by the US government intended at promoting entrepreneurship in technology in third world countries. And there was an Algerian team involved. I was connected with them through some contacts that I have. And I was able to act basically as a mentor to that team. Really bright people looking at what it takes to launch a startup. So it's not just about the technology, but also connecting that with a business component, and therefore how to implement entrepreneurship that can ultimately lead to deployed innovation, you know, for the economy and things of that sort. So that team was looking at how to solve problems like finding parking space, which is extremely difficult in that part of the world because cities and towns, they were not built for cars. And some urban centers, you know, have significant density of population. And so driving a car and finding parking is a challenge. So I like the fact that they identified a concrete problem, real one. And we talked about, you know, methodologies like lean startup. We talked about methodologies like agile and how can those methodologies be deployed in order to create, an engine of ideation, of experimentation, validation.
Was this in Algeria to local entrepreneurs?
Correct.
And a question I have for you is, how did they view you, Murad? How did you feel? Sometimes I feel like I meet South Africans and they sort of resent me for not being in the struggle in my own country. Other people admire my success. And so I'm getting a bit of therapy from you right now. But when you look in your people's eyes, like what do you see when you come back from the States with your successes and your sharings?
It's a very interesting, actually, journey, because at the beginning, when we were connected, there was a clear moment, maybe one or two sessions, where even things like language of communication, I tend to think in English when it comes to technology and innovation and things of that sort. So, but I made an effort knowing that English is not a primary language. It's either French or Arabic. And I was trying to use French to try to express, and I was failing miserably. And I was having a lot of challenges. And then someone told me, you know what? Use English. The team would be okay. And that's exactly what happened. So the team connected, accommodated, embraced the fact that we have to use English as a language. They did very well. The connection was good. And when we were not talking about the project, talking about, you know, aspects of culture, society, and so on and so forth. So by and large, we connected extremely well. I'd like to see more of that. So I'm glad you had this question, because this is something that frequently on my mind and making me think, how can I help? How can I give back in any way that I can?
Yeah. I really love talking to you about, especially because it's close to me, being an immigrant in the technology space, and especially from the African continent. So thank you for sharing some of your insights with me. I could probably talk to you for hours about this. But what fascinates you these days? What are you looking at, and what do you find fascinating?
Man, so many things are moving real fast. In my role as CTO in a tech company or startup, there's a lot that I do all the time that gives me positive feedback, including how to deploy innovation, how to leverage technological advancements, and what to keep an eye on, and how to drive for efficiency, how to build effective teams, how to repair deficient teams. All of the things give me a lot of things to look at all the time. I'm really excited about all of them. But more recently, the field of AI has been closing the loop on me. And I'm saying this because early in my technology career, I'm not going to say when, because I want to disclose how old I am. I had a first-hand exposure to AI when I was developing knowledge-based system. At the time, it was rule-based systems were the norm. And then I moved on to doing computer vision, where the approach was largely model-based, where a model could be a geometric model, could be a mathematical model, what have you. And of course, deep learning and all the subsequent advancement, generative AI, things are changing so fast, and it's closing the loop because I'm back to doing AI as of a few years back, whether it's machine learning or now generative AI. And I am absolutely thrilled and really excited. At the same time, concerned for a variety of different reasons. I'm sure we can talk about them perhaps today as well. At the opportunities and the prospects of being able to do things that we could not do before. How many of the ways in which we work, we find fun, we shop, how we learn, who we vote for, and all of the things now are enabled in ways that could not be enabled before. So really, really excited about all those things. And that's besides typical things that we look at any technological evolution, whether it's efficiency, productivity, and cost, and all that. I think we have something new that's really profound that's going on these days.
Yes, and what really amazes me is how the AI is really fine-tuning the models in our brains.
Isn't it? It's absolutely right. It's changing behaviors, and it's also interesting how quickly we're adapting. We're scared along the way as a society with everything that we hear and all that. But at the same time, we're adopting and embracing real fast because we seem to like the positives. We kind of are worried about the negatives, but we are, I think, focused a lot on what we can take out of that. Very much like all the things that we experienced before, whether it's mobile or otherwise.
My point of view is that it's profoundly different only because I know mobile sort of put computing power in everyone's hands. And yes, so now looking up information, whatever apps you're using, I still feel like the human had the command over the machine because in a way, yes, you were Googling stuff and you were extracting knowledge, but I still feel like our family, our friends, employees, everyone using technology, even declarative programming, is the human telling the machine what to do and how it is. And now we have this paradigm shift where there's this collective knowledge that has been presented to us in the form of language, which creates an emotional response. And the transformation that is happening is, I just feel like it's unlike anything I think any of us has seen. Or maybe the internet did that. We were all like, wow, we're all connected. This is magical. But man, this GPT stuff is an arena that I think is more uncharted. Even a connected internet is ultimately just a bunch of wires that connect a bunch of machines. Sometimes there's radio waves. But man, GPT and models, where we just don't know the corners of the permutations of the weighted, we just don't know what we don't know with these models. Man, I don't know if our society or our race, the human race, knows what to do with this.
I agree. And, you know, when you think about the history, basically the internet revolutionized communication, access to information, commerce on a global scale, and mobile basically brought this to everyone's hands, like you stated, so they can be done anytime, anywhere. What AI is doing is adding a layer of human-like expertise, human-like intelligence, which is really more than just enabling us to do things conveniently, which it does contribute to, but then this new layer around bringing expertise that helps us in turn feel more empowered, I guess, in ways that are close to our own humanity. the way we think about ourselves in terms of being experts or being people who think, people who make decisions, people who create. And I think this is where the paradigm shift is. It's no longer about us using tools to do things that we like to do, but it's about us finding a way to augment our own human intelligence. And that's different. We see a multiplying effect in terms of how we think about what we do, and is good and bad in all of that. But I think this is what we're seeing. I don't think that we're even beginning to appreciate or even anticipate what the impact is going to be ultimately. And that we're seeing some of that already. We started seeing signs of that, but I don't think anyone had appreciated or anticipated at that time. AI is not new. Obviously, AI has been going on for quite a while. And I think the two main milestones that led up to the recent exponential impact are, you know, when we start having deep learning years ago, which were really kind of specific expertise for either face recognition or chess playing and stuff like that, right? And then the transformer models, which added a layer around attention and how to identify in a sequence what matters the most in order to create human or intelligent generation and all that, things started to change. Things started to change significantly. And this is where the connection with us as people started to occur, as this technology being more than just a tool that is convenient to use, but a tool that is deeply transformative in the way we live, in the way we work, in the way we do everything. And I think there's a lot more that we will discover as far as we can do with it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that fascinates me about where we are with AI is the learning curve. You bring someone onto your team, or someone's a junior and then a mid-level and then a senior. The human brain's friction to learning and the effort required to create the new neural paths through repetition and understanding, comprehension and execution, just all of that stuff is gone with models. I mean, yes, it takes a lot of time to train a model, takes a lot less time to fine tune a model, but boy, I mean, other models can almost instantly learn from each other, and it's almost instantly replicatable. And that to me is a territory that is just very, very hard for us to imagine. You know, for instance, if you look at a code base, when we hire an engineer, we think, okay, you know, it's going to take them maybe 2 months to really understand and comprehend our architecture, our code base, and start producing and contributing. Whereas you present your code base to a co-pilot or an LLM, and it's just boom, it knows probably 70, 80% accuracy what's going on. I mean, it doesn't know it, but it has the context set up to be able to generate the code and the bug fixes and the whatever. And that to me is fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that's not surprising. And when you look at it, before generative AI, to learn advanced skills, whether it's coding or marketing, and we learn tools. And these tools have a paradigm of communication, right? They have a language, they have whatever. As a species, we developed spoken natural language as a means to conceptualize, to communicate for tens of thousands of years. So suddenly finding ourselves learning new paradigms, it takes time. We go to school for years and years to learn those things. And that remained the case for all the technologies so far. Whereas generative AI, it's a technology that came to us as opposed to us going to it. It came to us in the sense that it bridged the gap in the core notion of communication. So it brought itself to understand and generate natural language, which is the most natural thing for us to use to communicate and think. And the other thing that it added is this built-in intelligence based on vast amounts of data and the ability to generate contents that is human-like. So not only is ChatGPT, for example, able to understand my language, but it's able to give me very good instructions for my favorite chocolate cake recipe. So I connect with it, not just because it can understand my language, it can give me back language, but it tells me things that are relevant to me as well, and that are intriguing, that could take me a long time to figure out on my own. And that's really the multiplicative effect. And I think this is why the impact that you mentioned, Etienne, is so profound. And going back to the coding example, I think part of the paradigm shift over here is that thinking about how we have traditionally developed applications, solutions, and all that, there's always expertise. That expertise was embodied in the code that smart engineers have developed. And that value is accessible through user interface to some end user. The new paradigm here is that the expertise is more encapsulated in foundational model and agents and retrieval augmented generation and all the things that are trending these days, and they're accessible through natural language. So on the one hand, the bar is lowered to create advanced software, advanced systems because of all these foundational models. And the bar is further lowered from the standpoint of the end user as well. So we have a double effect over here that is contributing, and that will further contribute in the future into scaling AI and scaling the way it impacts all of us in so many different ways.
Are you ready to elevate your team's performance and your own career as CTO? Introducing the 7CTOs Growth Program. With 7CTOs, you'll join a supportive community of tech leaders dedicated to helping you reach new heights. Our group coaching program, led by experienced CTOs, focuses on the proven CTO levels framework. Assess your team, processes, and technology challenges with our easy-to-complete assessments, and then dive deep into monthly coaching calls where you'll get unstuck and gain insights on specific topics. Craft actionable plans tailored to your needs, guided by expert advice and playbooks designed to drive results. Plus, gain access to our exclusive CTO community for ongoing support and collaboration. Sign up now and start your group coaching adventure for only $300 per month or $3,000 per year. Your membership includes priority access to all 7CTO's events and activities. Don't miss out on the opportunity to join a global community of experienced CTOs, attend virtual events, and participate in confidential group coaching sessions. Visit 7ctos.com/growth and level up your leadership skills today. You're CTO at a company that I very much admire and love called Splash. One day when I'm a grown-up, I'll be able to afford your services, but I love Splash. I love what you do. I love your passion, the company's passion for communities and community engagement and the tools that you've developed. How are you CTOing the adoption of tools? How are your engineers responding to what you just talked about in terms of the coding models? How are you CTOing your organization through this revolution?
Yeah, great question. You know, it's inevitable as any CTO, and not just CTOs, frankly, even people who are in marketing, who are in sales, who are in HR, who are in customer support. Everyone these days is or will soon start looking at AI to see how they can leverage that technology to operate better, to provide new solutions or new ways of servicing customers. If we don't do that, we're going to be competitively disadvantaged. And if we don't do that, our customers also are not going to be aligned with us because our own customers themselves are doing the same thing. And so when habits are changing, they're not just changing for us as vendors of technology, as developers of technology. Habits are also changing from the standpoint of our own customers. And so for me, just like I'm sure every other CTO, it's all about how do we leverage AI so that we can enhance what we do, both in terms of customer-facing solutions, as well as operate better and be able to, when I say better, it may mean more efficiently. It may mean so that, for example, the developers can spend more time when creating value as opposed to doing some of the mundane tasks. I mean, you mentioned rightfully yourself earlier that a lot of the coding involves all the things involved in software development and, you know, creating code, creating unit tests, submitting to a pipeline, submitting a PR, approving a PR, and then deploying. A lot of that is automated for sure. But in my team, we're using GitHub Copilot, for example. Recently, kind of interesting, we started adopting it last quarter. And so a few months into the adoption, I wanted to check how is the team doing. So I had some occasional discussions with engineers, but I said, let me formalize that through surveys and get a little bit scientific about whether the intended value and impact on engineers is true. And very interesting, the results are very much on par with everything that I've been reading. Increased productivity, this is just from the mouth of the own engineers themselves, increased productivity as well as increased satisfaction, where they feel that a lot of the mundane manual things that they used to do now can be automated or auto-generated, whether it's code documentation, whether it's the foundational code generation, whether it's very fast and intelligent, relevant suggestions, especially as the tool adapts to not just the code that the engineer is looking at, but the engineer's own ways of programming. So it's early a little bit into the adoption phase, but it's already telling me that it's been a very good investment in terms of how to move the needle a little bit into our development capabilities.
Yeah. Hey, GPT, here's my class file. I don't know how to document this. Please, can you just write something concise, no more than 100 words? Boom.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So did you get your team sort of the enterprise GPT accounts?
I did. Yeah, I saw value in going enterprise for various reasons. And certainly data privacy and things like that was part of the decision. In our case, we use GitHub Enterprise, so that was a natural extension. But yeah, absolutely. The impact has been great. And the other part of the answer is, in terms of leveraging AI, you know, what we do as a vendor is obviously very much focused on allowing companies to connect with people. And there's a lot that's involved from the standpoint of communication, messaging, engagement, and things of that sort. And AI, especially generative AI, has proven to be extremely good when it comes to enabling those things to be done very well, whether it's in the form of personalization, whether it's in the form of content generation and things like that. So there's no shortage of potential over here in terms of how you can leverage AI.
Is there any coaching you have to do or that you find in your team that there are those that adopt it and those that are terrified by it and those that think you're making a massive mistake because of data, blah, blah, blah? Is there any coaching you're having to do on that?
Actually, a good question. Absolutely, yes. Not all the engineers are using GitHub Copilot. And those who don't sometimes feel more comfortable using ChatGPT, kind of interesting. And those who don't even use that still are comfortable looking up Stack Overflow, whatever old habits they had. I think the adoption varies according to the engineer. I think it's going to take time. That's part of the organic evolution. But what I think for these kinds of things to really work, what I think is important is to demonstrate as a leader of the team that I'd like those tools to be considered, that this is not just an interesting option, but this is a transformative option. So demonstrating that I'm invested in this and that the management team is invested does create a culture where feeling motivated, feeling that this is something that I need to look at. And also, I also get my engineers who use it talk in our engineering all staff opportunities and other engineering gatherings, talk about how they use GitHub Copilot and what the value they get out of that. So to sort of disseminate how they're taking advantage of the tool and create more interest and more adoption by the team.
Mm. Yeah, I think your point about Stack Overflow, when I was coding our systems and my developers, when you went to Stack Overflow, the code that you would copy out of Stack Overflow was usually limited to maybe a routine or a little snippet of code. And sometimes I don't think you really knew what the code did. And it's like, obviously you want to always know what the code does. But I will just confess that sometimes I'm just like, I just want this thing to work. And so this apparently sorts the algorithm. So boom, let's just do that.
Right.
I understand that that has already existed, but I mean, I think with the GPT route, man, or the Copilot route, you get chunks and chunks of code that possibly your developers don't know what it does.
Absolutely. And I am getting actually feedback from those who use the tool about the importance of being mindful of what to expect out of the tool, right? Of course, there's a lot of hype over there. And I happen to not think that GitHub Copilot will ever replace engineers. I think it lowers the bar. I think it bridges the gap between those who are experienced and skilled and those who don't have the same experience. It bridges the gap a little bit, right? But I think there's still a lot that the engineers need to watch for. The generation is not perfect. I think it's a time-saving tool. I think it's a tool that allows the engineer to focus more than before on areas related to actually creative coding, creative transformation of ideas into code, knowing that the generations still have to be checked, have to be tested. And even the makers of these tools ask us to do those things as well. Very much like ChatGPT, you know, in my chocolate cake, you know, ChatGPT may make a mistake in some of this. And my wife, who is expert coming from Algeria in cooking these kinds of things, she tells me, well, no, you have to replace this by that. It's not as easy as it sounds. So expertise is great. It's kind of somewhat democratized, but I don't think we are yet at a point we can think about totally replacing people. We're not there yet.
Yes, yes. Although this Devon tool just came out. Did you see that? The Devon, the engineer, just came out. I think it's a GPT-4 wrapper that does coding. I guess it's maybe just a prompt engineered GPT for coding assistance.
I think this will continue to evolve. I think this will continue to evolve in so many different ways. One area that I think this will evolve, and I was thinking the other day, is that now these tools are making it easier to generate code so that code can be submitted to our traditional pipeline and then deployed to production. I was thinking, at some point in time, will there even be a need for code to be generated to begin with? Why can't the natural language prompt? This is perhaps a little bit, you know, optimistic, and we're not, it's not going to be tomorrow, but I think there is a trend there, just seeing how agents communicate with one another, the market agentic generative AI platforms, where things are trending. So if you want to build a Copilot, you want to build, you know, things that involve an LLM or a bunch of LLMs, they communicate with one another using prompts. And so here we have potentially what we experienced with something like Java Virtual Machine, for example. We write high-level object-oriented code, and then the Java Virtual Machine takes care of running that for you, including memory management and things like that. Are we going to reach a point where we can write an application using natural language and seeing it run within this generative AI virtual machine that would essentially bypass for you to even look at whatever code it may have been generated as a result of your prompt?
I think 100%, 100%. And I think you know how we went, the big debate 10 years ago was the monolith versus the S service-oriented architecture versus microservices. Those architecture design patterns were all in answer to the cloud diversifying infrastructure to secure uptime and these massive Web 2.0 applications. But those are architectures that we've designed for declarative code. I mean, it's like, you know, you code assist. And also with architectures, we decouple the architectures not only for scale on a technical level, but also to empower our teams to be able to work on different parts of the systems without screwing each other over. I think that what you're describing is probably going to require a way of designing apps that we haven't maybe come up with. We haven't come up with design patterns yet. Maybe we have, and I just don't know about it. But we haven't come up with the architecture design patterns yet that will do exactly what you just said. Like, there's a virtual machine, in other words, an AI machine that you just put some stuff in it, and it's contained in a way where it outputs. Maybe the outputs are the AI's secret language. I mean, it doesn't have to be English, right? They can talk a language to each other that none of us need to understand.
That's intriguing and quite interesting. I think you're right. I think the way we evolve, the way we craft scalable, distributed applications has been largely driven by how technology has evolved until that time, building on even when we went to the cloud. We were architecting with that in mind. Even best practices have been put together with the well-architected framework and all of those things. And it's kind of interesting because the way large language models and generative AI-based infrastructure is evolving nowadays, just looking from the time just ChatGPT came out and where we are now, where we can have frameworks, whether it's open source or provided by, let's say, AWS Bedrock, for example, and LangChain and all the things you can find on Hugging Face and whatnot. Basically, they're evolving into the built-in, this architecture that you mentioned is built in because they have means to connect with one another. All you have to do is specify your workflow, specify your data sources, specify what plugin you want to use. Are you building something that helps people make a hotel reservation or to order something? But behind the scene, these agents, these components, these foundational models are essentially doing all the talking, doing all the orchestration, doing all of that. So we have less, I wouldn't say control, but we have less need to access that because now it's built into the thing as opposed to us having to build it into our applications. And I like that myself. I'm excited. I know it's not going to be perfect as we evolve into this, but I like it because it's part of the paradigm shift we're talking about earlier, so that what are we good at as people who love to create new ideas, new solutions that solve problems X, Y, and Z? What are we best at? And how can we do that at scale more quickly, more readily, and improve the way we do things? I think we are very good at expressing what we want in our own language, which could be Afrikaans, by the way, or any other language in constructs that may involve some kind of expertise I may have. I may be a medical doctor. I may be something. And so programming would, at that stage, no longer be something that specialized people called software engineers would do. Maybe, I'm sure we would, software engineers would still exist for specialized needs and so on and so forth. But down the line, the way, if we look at the trajectory and if we could anticipate based on this trajectory, I suspect that at some point in time, about anybody can implement, deploy a sophisticated application simply by using natural prompts and not have to worry about microservices or the cloud. Those will become given. I think this is very much like when we saw the evolution from, you know, if you look at how operating systems, virtual machines were an abstraction of hardware.
Compilers, yeah.
Exactly. Compilers, VMs being abstraction of hardware, containers being abstractions of the operating system, the cloud being abstraction of infrastructure. I think generative AI at some point in time, it looks like it is trending to becoming the intelligence platform. So all of the above is given. Now just focus on articulating what you want and the rest will be included, which is kind of a fascinating, fascinating thing to be able to do. I think it's doable, being everything that we see going. I don't know how it's going to take, but I think this is getting there.
Yeah, I think everything gets obliterated, like our concepts around what an app is, a concept about what a browser and a website is. I mean, all of these components are really just iterations and the conduit for a program that runs, that is iterative, that will provide business value that you can see with the eyes and buttons you can click. All of that stuff just flowed from mainframes back in the day. I mean, from punch cards it was just one track. And I think that this is where AI, specifically because I think, here's where I think the real magic lies. And this, I keep saying this, and I think people don't necessarily get what I'm saying because I'm such, you know, I can't communicate it clearly. But I think what blows my mind about what we call generative AI today is that we have now an interface that has the appearance of understanding what it is we're asking for. You know that time when you went to the Apple store for the first time after the iPhone came out, you touched the phone and the phone just like the graphics was moving and you just felt like, wow, I've got my finger can just touch the phone and the phone just wants to work for me, you know? That is a sensory hack. Your brain is like, well, hang on, there's this person or this thing that I can touch. And with AI, I just think what I don't hear people talking about is just that you now have a prompt. I mean, prompt is even more robotic than I would like to call it. But I think it's the idea that you get to type into the machine in your language or your understanding and the journey begins, the conversation begins. And I think that's another hack. The brain gets hacked into, hang on, am I talking to a person? Should I be polite? Should I be angry? Should I be upset because the result? It's just the fact that we can now, like you said earlier, the fact that software engineers are no longer necessary to be that translator between what it is that the person wants and telling the computer what to do has now been replaced by the computer has the appearance of understanding what it is you're asking for. And that's only getting better and better and creates a different kind of relationship for us with the machine.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And again, I think this goes back to the gap that is bridged now by and large in terms of how technology has gotten closer to the way we operate as species, as opposed to demanding vast amounts of expertise. In our history also, we've seen that when the printing press came up and who could print or who could even write. And when everyone had access to that, things changed significantly in the course of humanity. And we have so many examples in the history of innovation and things of that sort. So I think what makes this one special is no longer the mechanistic kinds of things that revolve around productivity or speed or cost. It's about an emotional link, as you stated, that is grounded on the way we think, the way we communicate. You know, I was looking the other day when OpenAI announced Sora, which essentially from a prompt, it generates a video. And I was thinking, the first thing that occurred to me is, what is the future of Hollywood? Because traditionally, if you want to see a movie, well, you go to the theater, you pay for a ticket, and you get to spend an hour and a half or so watching what some very creative people thought would be a good story to tell you. Sometimes we like movies, sometimes we don't like them. Now we are getting into an area where you can say, I want a story about this, and you can dictate your own story. And you don't need to pay for a movie ticket. You can stay where you are. And even though the video is generated like about a minute long or so, it's not going to take long until we see an entire feature film can be generated. And you can dictate, you can say what kind of characters. Like when we were kids, we would go to our mom, tell me a story about this and that. But that's what it's getting into. And that's further part of bridging the gap, because this is how we think. You know, we're shifting from consuming things as the product of what some producers produced to essentially being an active participant in determining what we would like to consume. And that's a paradigm shift, significant paradigm shift.
Murad, I wanted to ask you if you had a book recommendation as we close.
There's so many books in terms of AI and all of this stuff. I haven't read all of them, and I still have many of them in my list of books to read. One of them is written by Kai-Fu Lee called The AI Superpowers. Basically talks about how essentially the U.S. and China are in this global race for AI dominance. It's a really fascinating book, especially coming from, written by someone who has so much experience, having not just worked in the AI field, but having done that both in the US and China. It's really fascinating to see how the things that you and I have been talking about the excitement, that how it impacts our lives and all that, but how AI is also has another dimension, which is geopolitical nature. What does it mean for AI to be, to empower, to be so transformative? And what are the implications for either threats and opportunities for nations like in the US and China, certainly many nations in Europe and in Asia and all over the world, and try to figure out how can this technology be transformative as far as how they should articulate their own strategic direction as a nation, both in terms of security, both in also in terms of economy, in terms of society, in terms of governments, in terms of all those things. And we're all familiar with a lot of the current issues in terms of the risks around foreign actors influencing elections, for example, or putting cybersecurity on steroids using AI. And these are concrete national security issues and concerns, and AI has just made things more complicated there. It is an interesting book. It talks about those things, and it covers what the author thinks would be ways to mitigate all of that.
I love it. AI Superpowers. AI Superpowers by Kai-Fu Lee. Murad, thanks for hanging. This was great. I feel like we have a couple more hours in us for some stimulating conversation.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be with you, Etienne. You certainly instilled in me a lot of inspiration, frankly, given all the podcasts that I see from you and the people that you invite. I'm a big fan of yours and everything that you do at 7CTOs. I pride myself to be a member of that organization, and I constantly learn from there.
That's a wonderful thing to say. I appreciate that, and I'll talk to you soon.
All righty. Take care. Bye.
That's the show. Check out ctopod.com. Stay connected. We love hearing from CTOs. We love hearing from CEOs. Anybody who needs to get their CTO plugged in, check out 7ctos.com. There are membership levels for everybody, so it's never too late to expand your network, nurture your relationships, and please, let's see each other soon, like next week. Cheers.